Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How is the American West different from any other part of the country, and what makes the desert in particular such a fascinating place to examine the nation's starkest contrasts? Like countless thousands before him, my guest today is fascinated by the remarkable beauty of New Mexico, West Texas, Arizona, and the California deserts, yet troubled by the pervasiveness of economic inequality, drug addiction, and social and cultural tensions that are at times as harsh as the landscape in which they occur. Ruben Martinez is a journalist, poet, and the Fletcher Jones Chair in Literature and Writing at Loyola Marymount University. His new book is called Desert America, A Journey Through Our Most Divided Landscape. Ruben, welcome to Think.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
What are Americans looking for in the West, and is that the same thing today as it's been throughout our history?
It's a huge question. And I've spent, you know, the best part of the last 10 years trying to answer that, writing about it, living and traveling through the West. I consider myself part native and part sojourner in the West. My Mexican grandparents grew up in desert lands in northern Mexico and crossed the border like so many others. And then as a kid, I traveled through it with my parents on family vacations, and my imagination has always been inspired by the place for so many reasons. I mean, you know, we grow up as Americans watching the Western. We see the iconic vistas represented in film, of course. We also see it in great American modernist art. We see it in the photographs of Ansel Adams, in the landscapes of George O'Keefe or Marsden Hartley. And I think Americans are looking for themselves in the desert West in a lot of different ways, in hopeful, optimistic ways, but also there's a darkness that as a country we've encountered there as well. So it's a complicated journey when we go into that desert. It's a spiritual place. It's a place where people go to heal their bodies. Famously, the consumptives of the 19th century were told to go to arid places to soothe their lungs, right? In the New Age, let's say, people have been told to go to the desert to clean out their souls from the urban ills that populate, you know, their minds and bodies. So we go there for all these different reasons, and when we arrive there, often is not the desire that we arrive there with clashes with an even more complicated reality. The fact that it's a place populated by so many ghosts of American and Native history. It's a place where unspeakable horrors have occurred and continue to occur. The U.S.-Mexico border is smack dab in the middle of our iconic American Western Desert, and that place is not New Agey, warm and fuzzy.
Yeah,
you know, to say the least.
I mean, it really is fascinating because you think about how many times the desert Southwest has changed hands in just a few hundred years. So there's this sense that everybody wants it, everybody feels it belongs to them, and yet no one can stake an unchallenged claim.
Exactly. And I think you hit it on the head when you said, you know, everybody wants it. Everybody wants to claim it. That in itself, and I'm part of those legions, by the way. I felt that same kind of desire to claim it or to be claimed by it. I lived on and off, you know, for over 10 years out there. And I've never felt... I would almost call it almost a lust for the landscape, you know, and that was equal parts disturbing as much as it was, you know, endearing in a way. It's a very complicated romance, let me put it that way. But when you said, you know, to claim the desert, it's precisely that. Patricia Nelson Limerick, the famed Western historian, summed it up with the title of her famous book several years ago, Legacy of Conquest. It's one conquest after the other, right? The Spaniards come in, claim the desert, take it away from the native peoples. The Americans come in and take it from the Mexicans. Just in the last 150 years since the U.S.-Mexico War, there have been wave after wave of colonies arriving. And I would claim that these types of the new arrivals in the West over the last several generations, whether they were cattle ranchers or miners or just plain old speculators in the real estate sense, that's a kind of conquest by other means. Hmm. And just in the last generation, this most recent boom and bust cycle, we've seen a kind of demographic upheaval in the West, with a lot of people moving in and a lot of people moving out, and people swapping, land on a scale that's almost unheard of since the opening of the frontier itself. So it is a legacy of conquest, and the conquest continues to occur, but maybe just not in the ways that we imagine.
Yeah. You know, the boom and bust cycle is such an interesting thing to consider in the region, because when you think about it, in many ways, it the pattern reflects nature in the desert, right? This sparse subsistence conditions, and then the rains arrive and transform everything, but it's always only temporary, and then you have another kind of flattening out.
Well, the desert, of course, functions so powerfully as metaphor.
Yeah.
In so many ways, it's very elastic, and it functions perfectly in the way you just deployed it as metaphor for that. I would add that during the summer months, we're not quite there yet in the Southwest, but we will be in a month or so. The monsoon rains come, and those storms are astonishing in their power and their fury, and how much rain can be dumped in just an hour. You know, sometimes a few inches of rain that cause flash floods and that transform an utterly, radically empty, dry, dusty, hot landscape into, you know, in the matter of minutes, into this churning wall of water, you know, obliterating everything in its path.
Mm-hmm.
You could use that as a metaphor for the most recent boom and bust cycle. Talk about a place like Phoenix and how, just in the matter of a couple of years, real estate prices increased, in some cases, 200-300%, a frenetic cycle of speculation that saw tremendous fortunes being built up on the one hand, and then the middle class and the working class is kind of like dropping off into the abyss, and then, of course, the whole economy going off into the abyss with the crash of 2007-2008. That's almost kind of like a monsoon storm right there that we experienced.
And then places like Phoenix and like Las Vegas, which have seen this astronomical growth, in some ways, you know, anyone who's lived there or in the region knows that they're sort of built on something somewhat artificial, right? Because they've got to have water from elsewhere. They've got to have power that comes in. They're sort of not, the topography is not really sufficient to sustain populations that large and wealthy.
It is wholly unsustainable growth that has occurred over the last generation in the West. And I just happened to have flown across the border. I always have a window seat when I fly. I love looking at the landscapes, and I love flying through the Southwest in particular. And I was coming back from Mexico City, and that route takes you over the Sea of Cortez, Baja California, and you get onto the mainland right where the Colorado River used to dump into the Sea of Cortez. And now, of course, it's the Colorado River trickles out dozens and dozens and dozens of miles before the Sea of Cortez. It's just like this, you know, it's just an arid, what they call playa, you know, where water used to flow, but no longer does. The water, we've been stealing water and swapping it and finding all kinds of creative extra legal ways of making water flow into these cities. But with the onset of global climate change and the particular impact it's having on the Southwest, making an already extreme and volatile climate all that more extreme and volatile. In other words, you know, making the dry parts drier. We're beginning to see emergency meetings being held as we speak by water boards of the intermountain states and the desert states to see how exactly we're going to adjust to this new unsustainable reality.
In so many desert communities, there is, as you mentioned, this stark contrast between great wealth and abject poverty. And when those two classes come into conflict, it's pretty clear the wealthy have the upper hand. But the poor don't necessarily go away.
No, they don't. In the West, it's kind of like we're talking about, you know, if following the model that you're laying out, we're talking about the people on quote-unquote the losing side of history, right?
Yeah.
The native peoples, or the Mexicans that lost half the territory, which is now the southwest part of the United States. But there's still native peoples are still very much here. I lived in New Mexico for several years with my wife, Angela Garcia, who's an anthropologist, and that's the reason I wound up in New Mexico. She was doing her dissertation research in northern New Mexico in this beautiful, beautiful landscape. If you or any of your listeners have ever been, you know, Santa Fe or Taos, magical, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't call it the land of enchantment for nothing. Wound up on that landscape and because my wife was studying heroin addiction, poverty, in that very landscape, which is largely invisible to people that are, you know, seeking out that other kind of Western experience, right? I got a crash course on what else is in that landscape beyond kind of like the Ansel Adams, you know, or George O'Keefe landscape. I have to say that not only are the native peoples and the Mexicans and immigrants and people of color and working class people, of course they're there, and not only are they there, but they exercise, in some cases, tremendous amounts of political power. And so it might seem like, you know, the one and the 99, the battle between the one and 99 is a pretty lopsided type of thing, right? Corporate power will have its way. But in northern New Mexico, alongside the devastating problems, there's also an incredibly powerful political presence where Native Americans have made themselves felt and continue to make themselves felt. There's a transformation of Native economies because of the casino economy, very controversial that, but it's having an impact, certainly, on the livelihood of many Native Americans in many parts of the Southwest. And also just, if you will, you could say that it's a political power from below that's being exercised. And you see that even right now on a national political level in the debate over immigration reform. That debate began in the borderlands. That debate began in the desert. That debate began because people were dying out in the desert, or because, you know, some people, like, you know, the governor of Arizona, Jim Brewer, you know, thought they could make politics by trying to keep people like that out. There's to the extent that have a real debate going on about immigration reform right now at this very moment. It's a reflection of how much political power is also being wielded by Mexican American communities in tandem with their immigrant brothers and sisters. So on the one hand, the boom and bust, you know, is kind of a pithy way to sum up a radical history, you know, of encounters between disparate actors on that landscape. But the reality is that you know, on a day-to-day basis, there's a lot of negotiating going on, and sometimes the people you think have the least amount of power end up exercising a whole lot of it.
My guest is Ruben Martinez. He is Loyola Marymount University professor, chair, in literature and writing. His new book is called Desert America, A Journey Through Our Most Divided Landscape. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ruben Martinez. He is Fletcher Jones Chair in Literature and Writing at Loyola Marymount University and author of the new book Desert America, A Journey Through Our Most Divided Landscape. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Ruben, I want to talk about this. We have a tendency in this country, maybe in other parts of the country, to oversimplify our disagreements over immigration and to assume that everybody of Latino descent will have very unified views on the subject. And certainly, it may be that Mexican Americans in particular, even those whose families have been here for several generations, feel a certain affinity to newcomers, but they don't feel exactly the same as people who have recently arrived.
Certainly not. I'm not an immigrant. You know, I'm 1.5 generations. My mom immigrated as a young adult to this country from El Salvador, and my dad was born here, but grew up back and forth across the border. Mm-hmm. You know, so I call myself a 1.5 generation. and I've spent a really good part of my adult life as a writer, writing about the border and about immigration. Because it's kind of in my DNA, in a very profound way. You know, family reunions for us were the elders, after the meal with the coffee, you know, talking inevitably at some point nostalgically about the old country. Mm-hmm. And for a kid like me, that kind of like fired my imagination as a kid, and well, I wanted to know what that place was like. So I've been back and forth across the border throughout my adult life, let's say. And I know that my experience is very, very different than an immigrant who's just arrived here. And it's different culturally, it's different socially and economically, it's different in every way. Now, the way the immigration debate ran in the last few years, it went it went off the deep end in a very radical way, in the sense that the anti-immigrant part of the Republican Party, and I don't want to paint the Republican Party with a broad brush, because there are a lot of different positions within that party on immigration, of course. But part of it became extremely vocal and personified by Arizona Governor Jan Brewer and by the famous, you know, show me your papers law, much of which was invalidated by the Supreme Court. And when that happened, Mexican Americans, by and large, did unify. Famously, in California, in 1994, there was this thing called Proposition 187, which was kind of like a precursor to what happened in Arizona. It pretty much, you know, tried to do the same thing, deny public benefits to illegal immigrants. At that point, my own parents, were ambivalent about that particular law. It was a time of economic crisis. Mm-hmm. And my mom, who was an immigrant herself, just didn't know what to do. She said, you know, we're like on a lifeboat, and we can't save everybody in the world. And she was really torn. And exit polls showed that Latinos voted against the proposition, but not by that wide a margin. It was something like 55 to 45, something like that. Mm-hmm. So it shows that things change over time. What did happen with the most radical turn in anti-immigrant rhetoric in the last few years was it pushed a big part of the Latino electorate solidly away from the Republican Party towards the Democrats, and that's why the headline, you know, last November was Latino Vote Returns Barack Obama to the White House for a second term. So it's not a uniform lockstep type of situation. It changes according to the political winds. And goodness knows that a very ill wind blew on immigration politics in the last few years.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Mike in Las Galinas. Hi, Mike.
Yes, hello. This is another fantastic show.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask Mr. Gonzalez
Martinez.
What his observation. Oh, sorry. I beg your pardon. I'm driving, so I got to pay attention here. So, my fault. I apologize for that. My question is basically, as one that lived in New Mexico myself, what are the impacts that he's observed in regards to the military bases in New Mexico and California, and also the lives of the Native Americans, specifically on the Navajo Nation. So I'll just take my answer off the air. Thanks a lot, and I apologize for misspeaking on the name.
Thanks for your call.
No problem, Mike. Well, the military is omnipresent in our desert lands because, for obvious reasons, there's so much space in the West. I think back in the day, I think the idea, before our environmental consciousness developed, let's say, I think a lot of people thought, well, it's a wasteland anyway, you know, might as well bomb the heck out of it.
You
right?
can't hurt anything, was the thinking.
Exactly.
Yeah.
These days, it is very different, you know. The military, of course, is part of the government, and it follows an environmental rhetoric, at least. You know, famously outside of Camp Pendleton in Southern California, there's a big sign that says, Camp Pendleton, protecting, you know, the nation's environment. Also, where I used to live in the Mojave Desert in 29 Palms, which is at the edge of the largest Marine Corps right. training facility in the United States, they have to chart where every single desert tortoise is on that landscape, is so sensitive is the situation with endangered species. So that aside, the military situation in the Southwest is omnipresent, and it's an integral part of the economy. Places like where I lived in 29 Palms, the numbers of civilians working on the base. If the base went away, the local economy would completely collapse, and goodness knows that that's the case outside of Albuquerque as well, and so many other parts of the Southwest, and it also for me while I was living out there, I was living there during the years just after the first Gulf War, and in the run up to the second. And so I saw, you know, legions of young men and women come through to train because, of course, the perfect place to train for desert warfare is in the desert. And so we've had a generation or two generations of young men and women train on our arid lands for the duty that they've performed overseas. So the military is an integral part of that landscape. It's endlessly troubling. To environmental activists, of course, and there's constant tension there in terms of what is occurring on those bases and the impact on flora and fauna. On the other hand, people are tied to these installations because of the economy. So there's competing interests, as with so much else on the desert landscape. I think Mike also mentioned the Native American communities, Navajo in particular. I did not have a lot of experience with the Navajo Nation because I never lived in that area. I was next door, mm-hmm. actually, to San Juan Pueblo, which is today known as Okeowingay, and was kind of privy to kind of the changing political and economic fortunes of the Pueblo peoples of northern New Mexico. And just during a time when the casino economy was really starting to surge, which, as I mentioned earlier, has transformed not everyone's life, but some tribes, you know, have undergone economic improvement owing to the casino economy. Others have found bust, you know, mm-hmm. boom for some, bust for others. But some have certainly been transformed. And to the extent that some tribes have improved economically, it appears to have emboldened the sense of sovereignty and autonomy. These are sovereign nations, right? So much so that there's just one little symbol of this, I think. San Juan Pueblo changed its name to Okeowingay. Okeowingay is the Tiwa indigenous language name mm-hmm. of the original Pueblo. So, you know, for it to be the dawn of the 21st century, you know, hundreds of years after San Juan was christened by the Spanish conquerors, for, you know, the native tribe to cast off its Christian Spanish name and invoke its indigenous name, to me is a fascinating sign of sovereignty and autonomy and just the will of people to name themselves all these centuries later. So, you know, the culture wars of the desert, let's say.
You know, it's fascinating, Ruben, to think about, you know, so many of us are drawn to the desert for its purity, and yet we cannot help but change the landscape just simply by our presence within it.
Yes. And when I first started this project, I think I was driven in some ways by the idea. It was ambivalent. On the one hand, I arrived in the desert for a very personal reason.
Mm-hmm.
I was broke. I was living in Mexico City trying to write a book that I could not write. Typical writer sob story. You know, I was lucky enough to have had an advance, but I'd finished off the advance without writing a single word. And arrived in the desert because I also had a nasty drug habit at that time. And so I arrived broken and broke in the desert, seeking to heal. That journey in and of itself is invoking the desert as a pure place. Hmm. And so my imagination drove me there based on that idea that it was pure. And, you know, I was able to go out and sit on a rock and look out at an apparently empty landscape and try to get my soul, you know, back. And slowly I did. But even as I was immersed in that very personal, dark, you know, night of the soul type of journey, my eyes started opening to the complexities that we're talking about right now.
Yeah.
That are on that very landscape. So when we invoke the desert, or nature itself, by extension, as a pure place, I really wonder whether that's doing a disservice to us and to nature or to the desert from the get-go.
So in other words, we're sort of naive to think that we know what we'll find.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's almost like a willful ignorance, you know, because we know that it's not pure.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the moment that we set foot on it, we've already disturbed it. So what is it that keeps us willing for that pure place? Well, it's a really deep history of spiritual pilgrimage to the desert, which is present in the three great desert religions, right? Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. All of them have the idea of pilgrimage to the desert inherent, deeply inherent in them. So there's something, I think, in our kind of like spiritual DNA that drives us towards that pure place. And like I say, I'm there for that reason too. But I think we can do both things at the same time. I think we can be on a pilgrimage to find ourselves, but we don't have to get away from the complexity of our history on that landscape to be on that journey. I think you can do both things at the same time, in other words. And I think actually that you can't actually really clean out your soul without dealing with what's happening out on that desert landscape.
What did you learn by looking into the way that we have recorded the history of the desert west in America over the years?
There's a bookstore in Albuquerque. I'm just visualizing it right now as you asked the question. Called One Stop. Maybe some of your listeners have been to it. Page one, mm-hmm. up on Juan Tabo Boulevard, close to the Sandia Mountains. And it's a great used bookstore. The southwest section of that bookstore is like you're going to the New York Public Library. It's like row after row after row of wonderful first. I mean, every time I go in that, you know, I come out with bags and bags of books, and it shows how much we've been writing this history over and over and over and over. And I was very aware as I started to you know get the idea that I wanted to write my own kind of history, that I was entering this really, you know. It's almost like Borges, you know, talking mm-hmm. like the Argentine writer,
yeah.
You know, the Aleph, you know, it's kind of like, you know, dropping down into the most vast library, and I'm just like a mote of dust in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was overwhelmed by the sheer amount of material, and then just really became attuned to the political stakes in those histories. From a homesteader writing just about themselves out on, you know, some lonely part of West Texas in the late 1800s, to Frederick Jackson Turner, you know, writing about the frontier at the turn of the 20th century, to Patricia Nelson Limerick or Richard White, the new Western historians of the 1980s and 90s, rewriting that history. When we talked about conquest and claiming earlier, mm-hmm. people have been claiming the desert in the Southwest in history books and in memoir and in essays and in short stories over and over again. And the West has become, a more inclusive place. You know, the desert or the West of Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah.
You know, opened up a tremendous amount of space, you know, in the desert. You know, the desert that's rendered in the wonderful, you know, songwriter portraits like Joe Ely of West Texas, you know, or Lyle Lovett for that matter. I mean, there's the West is not just in history books. Of course, it's in pop music and film, and we're getting an ever more complicated version of the desert West as we go along.
My guest is Ruben Martinez. He is Fletcher Jones Chair in Literature and Writing at Loyola Marymount University and author of the new book Desert America, A Journey Through Our Most Divided Landscape. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ruben Martinez, who is Fletcher Jones Chair in Literature and Writing at Loyola Marymount University and author of the new book Desert America, A Journey Through Our Most Divided Landscape. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk a little bit about the subtitle of the book, Ruben, because you call the desert our most divided landscape and certainly illustrate throughout the book how this is the case. On the other hand, as is also clear, from time immemorial, or at least since we've had these sort of artificially created arbitrary borders, trade and wildlife and weather and ideas and people have had a way of completely ignoring those arbitrary borders.
Yes, of course. And, you know, the title and the subtitle, Desert America, were being half literal and half poetic.
Right.
Because when I lived in northern New Mexico, my northern New Mexican friends would be very offended that I called
it the desert.
Called them the desert. I lived in the farming village of Velarde, New Mexico, which is on what they call the low road to Taos, between mm-hmm. Santa Fe and Taos. And it's an apple orchard village. And it's at almost 6,000 feet. It's in the in a valley below the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, where there are peaks of almost 12,500 feet, coniferous, you know, mixed coniferous forest up there. The Rio Grande is lush and verdant with cottonwood trees. And there's also a lot of cactus. And there's juniper. And there's a lot of geological features that we associate with the desert. You know, stratified mesas and buttes, mm-hmm. Loamy earth. So it's a landscape that kind of splits the difference. You know, it's kind of really, really high desert, let's say, mm-hmm. you know, if it's desert at all. Or, you know, just basically high plains with a touch of desert.
Right.
So these borders are, yes, they're, you know, sometimes they're bureaucratic, sometimes they're symbolic. Sometimes they're, you know, the local tourism board, you know. So for the title and subtitle, I'm playing off of, yes, by and large, the places that I describe are either fully in the desert, you know, the Tohono O'odham Reservation in southern Arizona, for example, or West Texas, the Marfa area. It's high desert, but it's real desert. The Mojave Desert, in where I spent several years near Joshua Tree. That's real desert. But we're also invoking a metaphor. And the desert, as we've been talking, invokes so many parts of our imagination, both a place of purity and spiritual fullness, right, but also a scary place, a dark place, the place where the early Christian monks went out to battle demons, you know, in their desert cells, as they used to call them in the 4th century when St. Anthony of the Desert went out there. So we're invoking desert in a very, very elastic fashion here, let's say.
What do you learn living in the desert about the difference between solitude and loneliness?
I'm glad you asked that question because as I was talking about St. Anthony, I was thinking of my dear friend Douglas Christie, who's my colleague at Loyola Marymount University. He's a theologian and the author of a book about St. Anthony of the Desert, as a matter of fact, and he's just written a new book called The Blue Sapphire of the Mind, which is an attempt at what he calls a contemplative ecology. Mm-hmm. And in my personal journey to the desert, the first part of it was all about getting as far away as possible from people. Yeah, and you recall that I mentioned that I was in Mexico City,
yeah,
which is one of the most populous places on the face of the earth, 25 million people, give or take. And so I very consciously wanted to go to a place where I did not see another person. And also because I think, you know, because of my circumstances, there was great shame, and I was kind of like hiding. I wanted to hide away.
You're trying to run away from yourself in some ways.
Yes. I mean, I might have said I might have put on a game face and said, I'm actually going to find myself, but I was actually continuing, I think, the escape,
mm-hmm.
you know, paradoxically. So I go out there, and slowly I start to become aware that I'm entering a landscape that had received people in trouble, just like me, going back millennia. This was the same journey that's invoked in Dark Night of the Soul, St. John of the Cross. This is St. Anthony of the Desert. This is the Hajj of Islam. This is all those journeys, right? Mortification of the flesh. Whichever spiritual or religious doctrine you want to invoke, almost all of them, you know, take you into this solitary place where you have to kind of battle your own demons.
Hmm.
And that is by and large a solitary journey. You need elders, and in my case, one of my elders was my theologian friend, Doug Christie, who had made his whole, you know, academic career studying the lives of people who do just that. But at a certain point, you can't stay out there forever, because then you get the desert hermit who went crazy. You know, the one with the beard down to his feet, you know, who is just, you know, muttering, you know, non sequiturs.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be out there by yourself forever, and that's not the point. If you're going to be out there by yourself at all, it's to see, you know, what the stars look like at night in the Mojave Desert, where there's no when you're far enough out there, by the way, to not get the light bleeding in from Las Vegas,
right?
Which means pretty far out. You're out there to feel your place, ultimately find your place in the world and in the universe, so that you can come back into communion with people, back to your neighbors. That's the whole point. If you stayed out there forever, you'd be undoing the whole notion of spiritual pilgrimage.
Hmm.
And that, indeed, that's exactly what St. Anthony and the Desert Fathers do. They go out and they lock themselves away, but they come back. And they also establish communities of like-minded souls that are looking for themselves out there. And when I first went out to Joshua Tree, California, that was my first destination in the desert. Indeed, there was a small little, they wouldn't have called it an art colony, but it was a little colony of expatriates from Los Angeles who had started looking for themselves out there beyond the decadence of Hollywood and their broken dreams. And there was, of course, you need neighbors. You need people of who are also looking for themselves on that landscape. And that, I think, brings you full circle, you know, that this is a human journey and not one that's you're undertaking because you don't like humanity. It's because you love humanity.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Molly in Bedford. Hi, Molly.
Yes, I was curious, since the desert in the United States is such a vast and necessary ecosystem, I was curious if they had had, if he knows anything about if there's some kind of drone monitoring program in the sense of, as they're doing in some of the deserts in Africa, it's something to monitor it, and if he knows anything about a program related to something like that.
Okay. You said a monitoring program. What's the word you used before you said monitoring? You said drone?
Drone monitoring program, yeah.
I'm not sure what the drone monitoring program... You mean to track the ecosystem and its well-being, I assume.
I believe that's what she was talking about, yeah.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of research going on throughout the desert lands precisely because it's such a fragile ecosystem. I'm remembering just a trip I took out with some students from Loyola. We were lost looking for a particular campsite in the middle of the night, and we were going down this dusty dirt road near midnight, and our students were just trying to freak out. You know, we were way out there, and we came up to a barbed wire fence, and the sign says, University of California Research Facility, way out there. And we found out that that particular facility had been there 30 years, and they had fenced it off precisely to see so that no one would go in it and see how to restore places that had undergone tremendous exploitation. Because once again, you know, it looks like a pure landscape out there, but it's dotted. The Mojave is dotted with gold and silver mines. Right outside of Ajo, Arizona, huge open pit copper mine. So you come across mining and the tailings and the devastating effects of the extractive economies, and of course the way we've manipulated water, and you know the redundancy of desert drought that's occurring now through climate change. So we're studying. We need more research, obviously, to be done on this on the desert landscape, because ultimately, I think the desert teaches us a great lesson, precisely in its fragility and its beauty. The desert is asking us to regard life in that way, in that the planet Earth. It was in the right place at the right time for this amazing, you know, ecosystem to come together. Well, the desert takes that fragile balance and shows us just how fragile it really is. You just blow on it and it can, you know, go off kilter. So I think the desert is asking us essentially to live another way.
Yeah, I lived along the border for a long time in El Paso, and we sort of understood there that the rest of the United States did not get us, the rest of Texas didn't get us, didn't really think of us as part of them except, you know, sort of nominally. And it wasn't something that people lost a lot of sleep over. We just sort of understood it to be a fact of life. But I wonder if you've come to some understanding of why, you know, we can travel to other parts of the country and feel that we have a pretty good sense for them after, you know, a matter of days or weeks as visitors. Why is it so much harder to get a complete understanding of what the Desert West really means?
I think it's because of how history is lived. Just the way the history of conquest played out across the country in terms of manifest destiny, mm-hmm. going from east to west, the West was obviously the most recent place to be conquered. So the history of conquest here is, even though it's 150 years, the prophecies that were set in motion with the outcome of the Mexican-American War continue to be felt in a way, let's say, that, you know, the colonies on the East Coast, the first, you know, settler colonies, the repercussions of those initial actions, you know, of colonization, you have to look pretty far and wide to make the connections mm-hmm. of how life is lived today and to, you know, what occurred all those hundreds of years ago. Here, it's very clear that the descendants of people who were directly affected by those cycles of conquest are everywhere. They're your neighbors. And not only that, not only are they direct descendants of people, for example, as in the Pueblo nations,
yeah.
the Native American nations, and the Hispanos of northern New Mexico, who claim to go back 12, 15 generations, some of them, also every immigrant from Mexico that crosses the border is reminding us that there's a border between our two countries because of the War of 1848. Mm. And so every footstep across that border reminds us of that conflict. And one way or another, every footstep across that border says that that conflict isn't over, that the border is telling us, the border is not the end of the Mexican-American War. It tells us it's still going on. And as is evidenced by our vitriolic debate over immigration right now on Capitol Hill. So I'm with you. You know, if you lived in El Paso, that's as border a town as you can get. And yeah, I think those of us in the borderlands do have a sense of history that is different than a lot of other parts of the United States. I've often been told, and my knowledge of Hawaii is only very cursory, but you know, when I saw The Descendants, I got a little sense of it, you know,
yeah.
the film, that Hawaii is another place where history is lived in a particularly direct and embodied fashion, similar to New Mexico. So these are places where you don't need to go into a museum, in other words,
yeah.
to see history. You just walk along the street.
Ruben Martinez is a journalist, poet, and the Fletcher Jones Chair in Literature and Writing at Loyola Marymount University. His new book is called Desert America, A Journey Through Our Most Divided Landscape. Ruben, thank you so much for joining us this hour. Really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had production assistance from Lindsay Connect, and Christine McConnell produced the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.